Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at bordeaux.com.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Mary Izette.
From Forget About It. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Food talk. It's February still in New York City, and it got cold. Happy Valentine's Day, post-Valentine's Day, everybody. It was really cold up here that day. Nasty weekend. It got bitter. But I heard some people do really good business in the restaurant world. So I have to say, he's the next restaurant guy, and this is going to be offensive, but Valentine's Day, man, everybody hates it in the restaurant business. It's like the holidays are bad enough, but there's something about Valentine's Day that just sucks the worst. Part of it, I think, is the a lot of people that go out aren't like customer, like they're not like regular restaurant people. And then it's all deuces, which is like death for kitchens. Like there's no four tops, six tops, eight tops. It's like everyone's on a date by themselves. And so that's like death for kitchens. Like pick up a deuce.
The 3 hour two top.
Hopefully not, right? The 3 hour two top, right? And then it's like amateur hour. Like who are these people? Like they're not your regulars and they don't know the food and
they don't know what to order.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the most awkward day to be in the business because you know you're going to make good revenue. You're happy to have a day when you're sold out or packed or whatever. But it's like, holy shit. I can't wait till Monday.
You know, Amy Sedaris actually just wrote something about this. And
I heard that she said she liked Valentine's Day.
She likes being a server on Valentine's Day.
Go figure. I mean, that's Sedaris family.
So you might be alone in your cynicism.
No, I'm with chefs all the time. I'm with, and they're really honest.
Yeah, but chefs are always angry.
Well, I think restaurant people in general. But yeah, I heard that. I know she got a lot of, and she's funny. I hear Brother David's hysterical, and she's really funny. Anyway, the other voice that you hear, Bianca Miraglia, this is the first time we've met.
It's true.
We've only spoken briefly over the phone, I think, yesterday, because we just kept doing, apparently you are as bad with cell phones as I am, meaning a lot of times I don't have mine with me, or I just don't answer it, or, I mean, honestly, a lot of times I just don't have it with me.
I'm the worst human communicator.
Well, good. So between you and I, it was, real bad communicator with the worst human, so it was, voicemail. What the fuck? Do we exist? It's just but you kept coming up. We have so many mutual friends, so as I was saying, this summer I was having, my son's really into wine, and he really wanted to meet Pascaline. I mean, who doesn't want to meet Pascaline?
A dream to behold.
To behold. And so his dream was to have dinner with just me, him, and Pascaline, and we went to Fung Tu, and she was running late because she was with you. She was out in Red Hook.
Oh.
So what I'm you not sorry. Do, so I should flesh this out. So Bianca Miraglia is the proprietress of a company that you own, called Uncouth Vermouth. And what you're doing, I hate to even use this word. Can I not say artisan? Is there another way I could do this?
Oh, I don't know.
At this point, artisan and small batch, they mean nothing.
And craft, no.
Craft, they
all
mean nothing.
Yes.
I mean, Budweiser is a craft brewery these days, right?
Sure.
Coors makes an artisan.
Well, I heard that their beers are Beechwood aged.
Beechwood aged, cold filtered, Rocky Mountain pure. I know. It's like, what the fuck does any of this shit mean?
Right.
I know. So I am so loathe to use. And in the wine space too, it's like, wow, like organic.
I just say small manufacturer. I think that's kind of the easiest way to put it because whether it's artisanal isn't really up to me to say. I think so. As a definition, I just say small because that's accurate.
So your name came up there, and then not far after that, we had dinner again. My son and I with Alice Firing, who knows you. I mean, you just kept coming
my
up.
My sister,
all my wine friends. And, I mean, Alice, I adore. I know her for years, and
she's early
on the bandwagon for natural wine.
Fuck she's yeah!
Been on, and the wines of Georgia.
Let me tell you what I think about Alice. She is the tiniest person standing in front of the smallest army with the largest sword,
oh, that's
screaming.
So great.
you know, yeah. as she fucking, like, thrusts towards the enemy. Like, she's no joke, but she is seriously the tiniest human.
No, it's funny. It's,
but she's big.
I'm used to sitting down with dinner with her and having her on the radio. And the last time I had dinner with her, I remember, like, we stood up, give each other hugs after dinner. My God, she's, like, 5 feet, if that. And I don't think she weighs 100 pounds.
No, she's a dancer.
Was she?
She is still. She still dances.
Why does she keep secrets from me? Like, what kind of dancing? Like ballroom or
she does,
tango?
She does a lot of different stuff. She does like that Morris shit. She does some awesome stuff. She's got moves.
Damn. Why isn't Al? Now I'm going to have to give her shit next time I see her. And I'm going to see her because she's having that Georgia, that party at the Embassy of the Republic of Georgia in a couple of weeks. So she's been a real
cool.
advocate of Georgian wines.
I just bought her book.
The one that's the one that's coming out for the love of wine with the Cuervé on the cover.
Yeah, I just got it.
Yes. Well, that anyway. So how did you, what led you to this? What got you, you're a New Yorker?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Leonia, New Jersey.
I wonder, it's right across the GWB.
One square mile town right across the GWB.
Yeah.
And so, you know, basically, so effectively, I grew up in New York City. You know, our friends would tell our parents that we were going to the mall, and then we would, you know, jump on a bus or walk across the George Washington Bridge and get on the A train, and then we were in Washington Square Park buying drugs and, you know, going to Generation Records. And so I effectively had a New York City childhood, but I slept in the suburbs and went to school in the suburbs. You know, but I grew up with a mother who was raised in the Midwest. And so, you know, she grew like a ton of our food, even though we had like, you know, just a tiny bit of, you know, suburban land surrounding our house. And my dad, who was Italian, but, you know, grew up in Brooklyn during the Depression, was very much an alcoholic and had a ton of wine around all the time. And, you know, from my earliest meals, I remember having my own glass of wine. You know, at dinner, even when we would eat in restaurants, you know, when I was 10 years old, I would always have my own glass of wine. So I don't know. It's like I really can't say anything other than reflectively, we're all our parents, you know, and I kind of combined like really wanting to pursue like drinking wine and having a fascination for just how everything is made. Like I have a habit of making anything. Rather than having to buy it, you know, I always try to pursue making something myself instead of purchasing it, you know, or at the very least figuring out how and weighing the costs. So, you know, vermouth was a combination of my interests. I spent, you know, the better part of my early 20s learning all about the wine industry, whether it was working in an office for a distributor, working in vineyards, working in wineries in Oregon primarily. I spent 3 years out there, you know, like a little fucking sponge and just soaked up everything that I could.
Doing any from harvesting
literally
to pruning
yep,
to the managers,
exactly. yeah,
off-season
bottling.
Management, bottling, training.
Yeah, like
cleaning up the in the cellar.
Yeah, being a lab monkey, being a cellar rat, being, you know.
Mostly Pinot Noir?
What's that? Yeah, mostly Pinot Noir, yeah. Riesling, Pinot Blanc. Chardonnay.
That's great experience.
You know, Viognier. It's Oregon. There's some Tempranillo out in the gorge and some bigger, you know, cabs and Merlot. But I actually never really worked with those grapes too much. I mostly worked with Pinot Noir and Riesling.
That's what. And in your 20s?
In my early 20s, yeah. It was kind of like my formative education. And, you know, I had always thought that I would stay out there. And then I guess like that turning point for almost everybody I know, you know, where something happens with your family or something mm-hmm. comes up and then you make a choice and most people move home. And I was one of those people.
Gotcha.
So that's how I ended up in Brooklyn and, you know, eventually doing whatever it is that I'm doing.
Well, wait a minute. Whatever it is that you're doing. When did you start the business?
So officially I started the business in 2012.
So 4 years ago. More or less.
June of 2012, it was...
Let's bore down. So, I mean, I've been in the restaurant business my whole life as a chef, and I love wine. And in the last 15, 18 years now that I'm not in the restaurant business anymore and I'm doing media, you know, I'm traveling around, not so much the world, but around Europe a lot. I'm at the Crush for a lot of... We do TV shows around wine, so I'm visiting wine regions. I talk about wine. Obviously, Pascaline, Laura, a lot of my friends, a lot of the guests on this show are sommeliers mm-hmm. in New York City or wine people in New York City, so it's really a big part of my life. And the vermouth thing's fascinating because, you know, I had and don't laugh out loud, but I had, it was a sponsored trip. So Martini and Rossi flew a bunch of us over a while ago to just tour the Veneto, and they were dropping money like crazy. We're staying in
Did you get to add dark brown extracts?
Sugar?
To
Thank
a,
you.
To
yes.
A, to
so
a,
we went to the quote, the secret factory, and I'm like looking at this, and, you know, I'm trying to keep a straight face because by then I'd already discovered Carpano, uh-huh. which is, you know, a lot rounder and gnarlier and aged in oak, and sure. it's certainly got more weight to it, and I way preferred it. And, you know, and they're giving you like that monkey dance. So you're in there and it's like all these huge stainless steel containers. And then like the secret ingredients of the aromatics and the botanicals and the mystery roots and uh-huh. And, you know, boatloads of just, I think it's Harbel Trebbiano. I don't know what the base wine is. Do you?
Have you ever, so first of all, they generally advertise that it's Moscato d'Asti, you know?
That's what they're calling the grape.
Yeah, but have you ever tried to calculate the amount of vineyard space in Asti that grows Moscato?
It's not.
Like, for the amount of cases that they produce, it's positively incalculable land-wise how they could feasibly be sourcing all of the grapes, even, you know, from Italy alone, regardless of region. It's, like, really crazy. Anyway, not to shit-talk other craft producers.
Well, they're not. They're a brand. But so that means, so for the longest time, it was like the French and the Italians had a kind of a style of vermouth. But here's my question for you.
Well,
I'm going to shut
up.
What is vermouth?
That was later, because so vermouth is 8,000 years old,
first of all. So talk about that. Give me vermouth 101, and I'll keep quiet.
Aromatized wines, you know, were being produced before wine was being made with just grapes. So back, you know, kick it in the Neolithic era, they're like burying whole clusters of grapes in terracotta pots, digging them up a year later. So they were actually doing that with herbs and the grapes originally, because like all fun recreational drugs, it was originally a medicine. So they're making medicine, and then everybody likes what medicine does to us, so we take it recreationally, and that's, you know, why I am considered a controlled substance manufacturer. But
she makes vermouth.
but I use mugwort, so all my shit has to get tested by the government labs for thujone levels that they don't even know how to accurately test for. And, you know, it's all just regulatory. Like it's everything is a drug, you know, and vermouth is just one of the earliest ones. And, you know, regardless of name. So where Mut is the Germanic word, a lot of people say the German word, but it's not the German word. It's the Germanic word for Artemisia, you know, which at the time they didn't realize was a genus that contained 400 different species, you know. So back then they were calling a lot of Artemisia the same thing. And so they were classifying, you know, things like wormwood and mugwort as the same plant. We later discovered they're not the same plant. Anciently, you know, it didn't necessarily have to be Artemisia based, you know, when you look at other medicines like Hippocras, you know, which was like goat testicles and cinnamon and shit, you know, so there were lots and lots of different ways to make aromatized wines, as we call them today, aromatized fortified wines, as we call them.
Aromatized wines with goat testicles?
Yeah, because it was medicine and that, like, you know, cured your shit, man. You would try it if you were in enough pain.
All right.
But modern medicine now, you know, this drug is now just a recreational aperitif that we can enjoy with our fucking oysters. It's great. And the difference between, I guess, whatever it is I'm doing or figuring out what I'm doing, because I still feel very much like a beginner. And even though I know that I'm doing something that, you know, didn't exist in our lifetime yet, it's not something new. You know, it's a very like early 16th century style to just use plants that are in season and available, and that's what you're, you know, adding to the wine to make vermouth. So, you know, what I'm doing is a very old concept. I didn't intentionally do it that way. I didn't want to like be the medieval vermouth brand, but you know, I'm drawn to using local seasonal ingredients, and that's just how it kind of worked out. I'm not adding any sweeteners, which is very different. I'm the only one apparently right now, which I encourage young vermouth makers out there, stop using sugar. You don't have to. But, you know, it's cool because there are a lot of vermouths that contain sugar that I think are absolutely fucking delicious. And I drink them with great pleasure. And I certainly have nothing against it. It's just not my style. And my style is something that I'm just now starting to really kind of figure out, you know, what it is. Like, I'm just getting to know myself, if that makes sense.
No, it completely does. I mean, it's a journey, right? And you're relatively new at it, and it's
completely
this ancient tradition. And as you're talking, I just have more questions popping up in my head because you brought the first bottle of your vermouth that I've ever seen. Where would I buy it in New York City if I'm a retail person? Where would I go to buy it?
If you're kind of like downtown, I would go to Astor.
Astor has it.
Has it, Chambers
okay.
Street, Frankly Wines.
Great, okay, great.
So those are really stores. Really good central locations, I would say.
And is there, because as you were just talking, these little bubbles are going up in my head, like questions. So, I mean, again, back to these generic brands, but I mean, even Carpano, which is not so generic, but I guess it somewhat is, but to me it's, but there's a style that's the same bottle to bottle all year long.
I would say that, yes. So I would say that almost, with few exceptions, almost every vermouth worldwide, whether it's French or Italian, is a Carpano-era style vermouth, right? Where you have bitter herbs and roots and, you know, generally containing gentian or cinchona, and, you know, they're steeping, they're aging, and then they're adding sugar, you know, to make them delicious because they're so bitter.
And coloring agents?
A lot of them have, absolutely. I mean, people generally think that red vermouth means it's made with red wine. You know, I have three red vermouths that are colored with vegetables or fruits, and I joke that those are my red vermouths because it's actually caramel coloring is what's making red vermouth, you know, which of course is like a great disappointment to someone like me 10 years ago who thought vermouth was like the coolest fucking thing, and I didn't necessarily see myself making it at the time, but I was totally into it. And then, when, you know, you find out all of these things, and it's like, you know, it's like being a little kid and finding out like the tooth fairy isn't real, you know. It's it's really upsetting, you know, when you find this shit out, and then you're like, all right, well, how do we improve this? Because I know that it hasn't always been this way, you know. And how do I approach this like I would approach winemaking, you know, where I'm not adding all this bullshit? So that's just kind of
winemaking in the natural sense of winemaking.
Sure,
right.
Another useless word, yes.
Right, but another useless word. But you know, yeah, what I mean? Like 95% of the wine industry is bullshit. There's so much
of
stuff
course.
That goes into wine that people don't know, that does not have to be on the label, that's manipulated post crush to create
hundreds of ingredients that are harmful and absolutely not food. I mean, this whole big thing just came out on Bordeaux about how, you know, their pesticide levels are testing like 100% higher than the legal amount that's allowed in drinking water. And so you're like allowing these chemicals to extract themselves in alcohol, which, you know, can in some cases amplify, you know, what they're going to do to somebody. And you know, it's like perfectly acceptable, but you could never allow that in a town's, you know, reservoir for drinking water.
Correct.
You know, that would never be allowed. So it's really just fucking bonkers. Like, I don't even know who's paying off who anymore or how it can even be this way. It's just so crazy. But, you know, the bottom line is that it's because of bureaucracy and that, you know, everything is super regulated, and especially in the U.S. post-prohibition, we weren't dealing with just one governing body for booze anymore. Now we're dealing with 50, you know, and it's, you know, I mean, it's just way more impossible to change anything
and
now.
Don't get me started, because I'll back that lens up and just tell you that food laws, labeling laws,
completely.
We are the, like, Europe is so far ahead of us with this stuff.
Absolutely.
Like, you can kind of put something in a can or a bottle or a jar, call it any bloody thing you want, and no one's going to hold your feet to the fire.
Honey, you can put anything you fucking want and call it honey. It's so gross. You have to know your producer no matter what you're eating.
Yeah,
you
no,
know?
America's labeling laws are just absolutely porous. So tell me about how you make your... So this is what I'm... So I'm... Now we're going to get specific. So you're located in Red Hook. That's where your operation is.
I am. I've been in Red Hook since 2012. My business was sort of incubated, you know, on the pier in the Red Hook Winery, and I've been in my own space for a few years now. And I last summer, bought a farm in Saugerties, New York.
Yeah, upstate on the other side of the Hudson.
Yep, exactly, on the west side of the Hudson. And I am developing...
For botanicals, for ingredients.
For all edible plants.
Right.
I like the term edible plants because, especially for young bartenders out there who are making their own stuff, and everybody who, you know, I want to murder for putting things like tobacco in their bitters, for instance, you know, and just serving people straight up poison without having any idea. I'm just trying to stress that when you're creating things that are aromatic, just because something smells pretty doesn't mean that it's actually edible. And, you know, especially if it isn't edible, you don't want to extract it in alcohol. So, you know, I prefer the term edible plants over botanicals. That's my long drawn out explanation.
Point made.
Yeah.
How do you choose? Because this must change during the year, because again, you're buying in batches. What is the base alcohol? Is it a specific varietal of wine?
No.
Is it always white wine? What are you looking for? Do you get it? How do you get it?
It's crushed to tank. The grapes come in from the North Fork of Long Island and the Finger Lakes.
That's where you're sourcing from, New York.
Uh-huh. Okay. And crushed to tank, it's made at Red Hook Winery, which is just an absolutely gorgeous facility. You know, where they already have all of their shit together, whereas when I started, I had no money. And so it was crucial, you know, for me to be able to, you know, have, you know, like a, you know, a source where I didn't know how much wine I was going to need. I didn't know, you know, and if I was going to make it myself in a custom crush situation, then, you know, then you're getting married to all kinds of people. And I really just wanted to be a one person company, and I wanted to be able to grow my business organically, without any, you know, outside investments or needing, you know, or getting to a point where I needed that. So the only way to do that is to not be a winery basically, or to be, you know, an even smaller one than I would need for my purposes. So, so they're amazing, and they have wonderful relationships with, you know, in my opinion, some of the absolute best vineyards that New York has to offer. And, you know, it's crazy because when people try my vermouth, you know, all over the country, and then, you know, like I just got back from France, they have...
That's right. You heard that. That's so cool. Anyway, keep going.
They don't realize that New York has an upstate. They don't realize that it's not just this dirty little city, that it's actually a big fucking state that's mostly farmland and woods and vineyards and orchards. You know, it's crazy how many people don't realize that, you know, and so I was all over Paris saying, you know, upstate New York, where my farm, upstate New York, and people are like, oh, Vermont.
No, but yeah, point made. Yeah.
Right. And so I just like constantly had a map up of, you know, my starting point in Brooklyn to where my farm is, so they could see just how close it is,
right.
You know, how it's closer than driving from Paris to the Loire, you know. And and so anyway, it's just really funny because even within our own country, most people don't realize just how much New York has to offer edible plant wise. You know, we have amazing, amazing farms here.
A huge tradition. We were completely wheat state for a long time.
The biggest hops producing state before Prohibition. The biggest vermouth producing state before Prohibition, believe it or not, was New York.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you brought me a bottle today.
I did.
Let's do a DNA on that bottle, because we could go on and on about where it kind of... I want to bore down.
Well, that
what's
particular
the great
batch...
What is it?
That particular batch is batch 14, and they don't have names. It's all about the artwork. And the reason for that is, you know, I started with three years ago, and now I have 10, and I just... It got out of hand, and I don't know what to call them. And so I legally can't call them after ingredients because, you know, you would have to list every ingredient on the label in order to do that. Like my boy at Ransom lists every ingredient on his vermouth label, which is really baller, but I don't want to do that because girls got to have her secrets. And so for me, you know, it's the artwork. I try to make it a little obvious, and I refer to them after, like, a couple of the ingredients I'm willing to admit. So the one that you have is batch 14 of what I often call apple mint, which is a type of mint. There are no apples in here. Any apple notes that you might be getting are probably from the Chardonnay. It's 90% Chardonnay, 10% Riesling on that batch. And it changes every batch. The plant composition is lots of plants. They all have around 20 different plants in them. And, you know, for me, the fun of vermouth is the fact that it's a secret formula. You know, I lie in my notebooks so that shit dies with me. And, you know, it's...
So how's it made? So I'm going to keep interrupting. So you have the wine available. So this is 90% Chardonnay, 10%
sometimes
Riesling.
Sometimes the wine is finished. Sometimes it's not. It depends on the time of year. It depends on what I'm doing. You know, if it's a sweet vermouth, it means there's either a fruit ingredient or it's late harvest grapes. So made the expensive way, in other words.
Right.
So fortified dessert wine, if you will.
Right.
Fortification is, you know, jumping up the alcohol percentage by adding a fruit spirit. So for my purposes, I use single distilled native New York grape brandy that they make special for me at Finger Lakes Distilling.
To get it up to 20-something?
I aim for 17%.
17?
Yep.
70%.
To me,
which
that's
isn't
the
a huge
honey
jump,
spot.
Because the white wine might have been, any Chardonnay might have been 12, 12 and a half, 11
exactly.
and a half, 12.
It's a slightly stronger glass of wine. I use a 500 milliliter bottle, so if you drink the whole thing, it's the equivalent of drinking an entire bottle of wine. That's kind of how I look at it. Exactly.
I drink bottles of wine all the time.
Right. So I kind of looked at that as like, okay, that's like safe for personal consumption. I'm not like ruining anyone's life if they drink the whole thing.
And then this, and the, so we're not going to ask what the herbal, but so this.
I approach every batch differently
right.
because I'm still learning. So,
but so how is the extraction of the flavor done? Because there's no heat applied. It's just a slow, it's just a maceration
yeah.
at room temperature?
Yeah. Occasionally I'll use heat, but it's rare. If I do, it's to extract something that's really super delicate. And if that's the case, you know, I would never, you know, bring it to a boil
right.
because as long as you keep it, you know, under boiling, you're not actually degrading the alcohol percentage. So, you know, for me, it's all about trying to stay true to the wine. So those are rare occasions, but I will admit that that is a method that I'm not ashamed of to a certain temperature. However, for the most part, it's just cold. Steeping in the wine is preferable for me because I feel like in the brandy, it gets kind of over-extracted. And I'm not looking to, you know, make like a house-infused rum for the, you know, happy hour right. mojito. Like I don't want that shit to turn brown and not resemble what it did when it was still a plant. So I'm trying to really kind of stay true to all of the things so that they become one happy cohesive
right, like
beverage.
Tiptoe around it to some extent rather than hitting
yeah,
over the head.
It's a delicate
hammer.
Process. You know, I think that the issue is people really want it to be, okay, you put all this shit in here for this long and then you do this. But, you know, for me, every time I'm in production, it's like having a newborn baby, you know, and some babies I know are going to sleep through the night and I leave them alone for a few weeks. And some babies I know I have to be tending to every 6 hours and shit. So, you know, it really just depends on what it is I'm making. And it also depends on what I decide to put myself through to make the highest possible quality vermouth that I can. And the more attention I pay to it, the better it comes out. And so, you know, for that reason, it's just not an easy process. I'm not using extracts. I'm not using pelletized plants. I'm not using chemical additives or sweeteners. So for me, the balance can only come from the wine, the plants, you know, whole plants and the brandy.
Would there be a reason or have you used or is there any oak integration for any reason?
No.
You
only
all stainless.
Yeah, only for my Amari batches. Sorry, I'm chewing ice from my...
From your drink, no worries.
Magnificent
so you do Amaris
cocktail.
Too? You do Amaris too?
Yeah, I have Amari batches going, Solera style. This is the second vintage of them, so I have 2 years going so far. And I was going to bottle some from the first year and... a couple of things happened. Too many people wanted it, first of all. And secondly, it's just way too fucking expensive for me to part with. You know, so I need to create enough of it so that I can also have my own personal library. So in this respect, the blending has a lot of motives behind it. It's not just necessarily because I wanted to, you know, blend everything and, you know, make it as good as possible. It's also because, you know, if I had bottled some, it wouldn't have even been enough at all, and you know, you're just pissing people off all the time if they can't have what they want. And I already piss people off all the time because it's seasonal.
I know that you're working with Pascaline for the when it reopens, the reopen of Rue Chemin.
I'm gonna knock on wood.
Yeah, I mean, let's hope. I think they were talking a month ago about hiring and starting training in March.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's been pushed to April. I don't even want to know. Knock on wood, whatever.
Just had some bad luck. It's gonna be great.
I mean, I know it's gonna be great. I know the chef.
Everything worth doing, you know. Always, you know. Sometimes you have a hurricane.
Yeah. But so you're doing a vermouth specifically for her?
Always. I'm always making vermouth for Pascaline. Honestly.
Is she the only one that has that treatment?
Absolutely. Right now.
Okay.
I have on occasion made a couple of things for other restaurants. And then, you know, I also am doing a couple of projects, you know, just with some distiller friends that are, you know, coming up in the near future, but, you know, nothing big. And and, you know, Pascaline is such an important person for our industry in general. She honestly is such a big reason that, you know, people give a shit about a lot of weird stuff out there, you know. And she has been so supportive about me exploring, you know, and using her as a barometer and also her customers, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that we collaborate on, you know, that I end up making, she'll serve, you know, with her tasting menu. And so, you know, like there are a couple hundred people a day who are tasting this like weird ass New York City vermouth and have no, you know, and have no idea what it is, you know. And so it's great because it's been the best way to get feedback, because she's like, and here, drink this, you know, rather than people having to find it on a menu and, you know, take a chance on and, you know, generally speaking, be disappointed that it isn't sweet. But, you know, it's cool because I think that she's responsible for people pairing a lot of weird stuff, you know, with meals.
What would you pair this vermouth with that you brought for me?
Oysters.
Okay, fascinating.
Absolutely.
Oysters, okay.
Yeah.
And so so you make a living. You're cool. This is what you do.
I haven't, like, paid myself yet, but who does that? No, every
you have
cent.
To pay yourself. Girl, that's called making a living for it.
Well, you know, for me, it's about, you know, my bills being paid, first of all, because anybody my money is going to who isn't the government is a very small business.
Right.
And so, you know, for me, my bills being paid and every cent going into growing, you know, whatever it is I'm doing, whether it's like, you know, buying 16 acres in a 200-year-old house, you know, it's everything is all about just figuring out where this is going to take me. I really have no idea. You know, but I grow more and more obsessed, and every year I work with more and more and more plants. And so, you know, I'm not losing interest, quite the opposite. And, and to me, that's a little more important at the moment. You know, I feel like I'm still young.
You're not even 30, right?
I am, actually. I'm 32.
God, you're a baby. God bless. So Bianca Morali has been my guest. Uncouth Vermouth in New York. You can buy it. Chamber Street is one of my favorite stores.
Absolutely.
Period. David, I had him on. I think last week he was the whole show. I mean, we just could not stop talking.
That store is a gift.
It's a gift. It really is. It's as my Jewish friends say, it's a mitzvah to the city.
It's
He's
true.
Just so passionate. He's great. It's the most well curated. And to my palate, it's just. And his price point. I mean, that guy's got more great juice between $15 and $30 than any other store anywhere on planet Earth.
I think that.
And the staff is just dope knowledgeable. Like the kids, the kids that are just stalkers know more about wine than I do, I think. It's nuts.
Totally.
They're just geeks. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank
We're going to do something with television
me.
This year. I'm going to email you. We're going to have to get better communicating.
Yeah,
I really
want
to get out. I want to do a story about you. Maybe we'll throw Red Hook Winery in there because they're a great story.
They're the best.
The Good Fork. Hometown Barbecue.
Right on.
You're all kind of in that Van Brunt quadrant down there. Let's make that happen.
Cool. That sounds great.
Thank you. Is Simran and is my next? Good. Super. Thank you. We're going to take a quick break right now. Again, my guest was Bianca Morali, Uncouth Vermouth. Look for it in a store near you. Or just go to Astor Chambers. You'll find it. Stay tuned. I've got a great guest coming up. Another person who I've never met. She has a book out called Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. And we are going to talk about that. Simran Sethi will be next in studio right after this spot. Hey, folks. Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients. And these days, we have so many options to choose from. Well,
I go back to the Cola Vita family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Cola Vita's living in Rome, Cola Vita's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well. So when you think of the great wine regions of the world historically, I mean, you're going to be led back to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, okay, maybe Piedmont, Italy, too. And as a chef growing up, boy, if you were working in great restaurants in the 70s and 80s, they were mostly all French, and we grew up drinking Bordeaux and Burgundy and Champagne with impunity. Well, fast forward to today, and I just got back from the 2015 Bordeaux harvest. We were there for a week with a bunch of sommeliers. It was so much fun, and I'll tell you, this isn't your grandfather's Bordeaux. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons working with this great terroir that they've lived on, this soil that they know that they've grown up with, and the great varietals that we all know and love, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec. You know, this style of Bordeaux now that's younger, that's fresher, that's meant to be consumed now and not cellared, because honestly, which of us has a cellar? And who wants to buy a bottle of wine and wait 10 years? So the Bordeaux whites are amazing, Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, like, hello, two grapes that we know. The reds are all sorts of different stories, from the left bank style that are a little more Cabernet Sauvignon driven, a little more structured, right bank a little more Merlot, a little easier, a little more upfront friendly. But if you haven't thought about drinking Bordeaux wine, give it another shot. For $15 to $35 in that price range, which is my price range, there's tremendous value in there. So if you're walking past a Bordeaux aisle, stop, grab a great bottle. These are some of the most food-friendly wines on planet Earth. Hey, welcome back. Mike Colomeco here. My guest is Simran Sethi. We've never met, and I get a lot of books sent to me. Most of the time, I don't really cover them on the show because a lot of the books that come out are recipe-driven cookbooks by people that don't know how to cook in the first place or just stupid shit about cupcakes and stuff I don't care about. But this is interesting, so I kind of want to get your story. So the name of the book is Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. And it's kind of like, I don't want to say it's autobiographical, but to some extent.
Yes.
It's sort of, it's your story.
It is.
It's not a story of, it's not like you've taken a cause and this is your thesis in a debate. You're sort of kind of like tracking your life in different points and saying, I was here and this is how I felt, and I was here and I was, there's kind of this narrative journey throughout this book.
Well, I tried to take the topic, which is the loss of agricultural biodiversity, and make it personal. What I didn't realize when I set out to write this book, Michael, was that the personalization would come from my story. And as I kept writing and kind of, you know, there was just a little bit of my experience put in for flavor, my reader, my editor kept saying, we want more of you. And I was like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. Like, really? And that ended up being the hinge. I ended up being kind of that narrative thread. I never expected to be that. But
it makes it a much better read.
It does. It does. I mean, it makes people be able to connect to loss.
Right. Otherwise, it just sounds like, I don't want PBS, like another NPR or another Heritage Radio show that's kind of didactic and doctrinaire, where everyone agrees with each other that the planet's dying and what are we going to do? Let's all wring our fingers and cry.
Earth is crying.
Right. Yeah. The earth is crying and let's plant gardens and live off of whatever.
Right.
But what led you to this? What in your life led you to this mission?
God, I want to answer this in so many ways because we've started with the personal thread. Everything led me here. The sense of loss, heartbreak led me here. And what I mean by that is, just to break this down for people, this isn't a book about cupcakes or about recipes by someone who doesn't know how to cook. This is a book about the slow loss of foods we love, meaning the loss of agricultural biodiversity, an erosion of diversity in everything that makes food possible, from soil to seeds to the pollinators, from plants to animals to aquatic life, that this idea is that we have become become more homogenized in everything we're eating and how we're treating the soil, in the kinds of varieties of stuff that we grow, and it's really compromising our food system, not only in the sense of shrinking down varieties to just a handful of crops, which is a treacherous way to kind of sustain the future of food, but creating something that's less nutritious and less delicious. And what I wanted to return to was this idea of, do we want to settle? Do we want to settle for something when we have this opportunity to taste something exquisite? Do we really want to settle for mediocrity? And I looked at my life and the struggles I've had and the jobs I refused and the men I've broken up with and the ones who have broken my heart and thought, if I had wanted to settle, I would have done that a long time ago. And I'm not going to start now, and I'm not going to start with food.
Yeah, the only thing I was so surprised about, because you're bright, you're plucky, but I'll go, how the heck were you sitting in hotel rooms ordering room service?
Dude.
Girl, what is up with that?
Dude.
I mean, just go out and eat. But that was you.
That was my shame. That was my story. I'm a women's studies major, too. Like, I am a primo feminist. And yes, I end the book talking about this journey, this kind of sitting alone in Peru over a plate
and
of
I love
octopus.
Where I know the Mercado. I know where
yes,
you went. I know
so
that.
Good.
I love
Isn't
that
the
guy.
Greatest?
He's a rock star, the guy,
oh,
the
yeah.
owner. He's a skinny guy. He surfs every morning.
Incredible.
He's super animated. He talks like this. And then if you sit at the bar, a lot of times he's there and they're doing the tiradito and they're doing the ceviche to order and they're adding
it's spectacular.
Brought you to tears.
Brought me to tears. Well, and so here's the deal.
Octopus.
Yes.
You're eating this specific dish and it's revelatory.
It's revelatory. But the key is I start to cry because the dish is so exquisite. Because I'd had octopus just a few days before in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was good. Yeah, it was good. But this was something else. This was transcendent. This was the way I experienced this. There's a moment in coffee. There's a moment when I taste a chocolate. Well, I say with chocolate, all of them have been, because chocolate has been my lifeblood. But there's these moments when you're like, oh my God, the food reaches out to meet you, you know? And you just, we all know what that feels like. It's a different food. It could be yuca in a bucket in Cuba. It could be, you know, a taco truck. It could be Roberta's. It could be, you know, Chez Panisse. I mean, all of these things, all these opportunities exist. I'm sitting in Peru. After a really tough work assignment, and I...
Yeah, you'd written it. You'd had this great thing, this point of view, this kind of thesis, and it's 45 minutes to an hour's worth of material.
There we go,
and then it gets
down.
crunched down, and they said, well, yeah, can you do this in a minute?
I self-edited it to 1 minute.
How is that possible? Like, what's the in and what's the out?
Trip. God. Well, you know, everything was running late, and they kept saying, and then all of a sudden I cut myself down. They're like, oh, we have 15 more minutes, and then everybody else goes on and does their full speech, and I was like, oh, really? So anyhow, there I am wanting a really good meal. And I don't, like you said, I've traveled all over the world. I've done, you know, tons of lovely, fancy things on media. And I order room service or takeout because I feel tremendous stigma. I felt, past tense, tremendous stigma about eating alone. I'm 45 years old. I don't want to be the chick eating alone.
It's an American thing.
It's an American.
It's a very American
thing. Well, you know what? Actually, I will argue, when I was in Italy doing research for the book at the Food and Agriculture Organization of Bioversity.
So the guy, you're sitting down, and the way, first of all, you're early, because you're eating at 7, which is like, are you fucking kidding me? That's like the Blue Plate special.
I mean, drawing attention to me because I'm early, because I'm hungry.
And then you got this Italian guy who's going to be all these Italians. They're all the same. Oh, my God. First of all, you're beautiful. Second of all, are you alone? Third of all, oh, my God.
Perché?
Why are you eating by yourself?
How is this possible? You're eating alone? So he spent...
Perché?
Perché? Bellissimo.
Grazie. Quanto sei bella, sai.
And so here I am, like, being even more embarrassed because I'm getting so much attention, you know, sort of thrust upon me.
Correct.
Because I'm alone in Italy.
Some of it unwanted.
Some of it, well, it's just, you know, too much. Like, yeah. I just wanted to have my meal and be in peace. And, you know, he's wanting to overcare for me.
Yeah.
And then here I am in Lima. I've, you know, called from the United States. I want to be at El Mercado. I want this meal. I want that tiradito. And
they don't. And they shit on you. You come
in as a
single. Well,
they put me in the crappy seat. And
yeah.
I'm seeing gorgeous two tops.
Right
in the middle of the restaurant.
Right.
You know,
right.
Fantastic, comfortable, et cetera. I said, no. And it was the first time
Where was your seat in that room where they put you? I'm just trying to figure out
the
room.
It's the same big room.
There's one big room with a big communal table in the front and then a big bar area
and then the
kitchen behind.
Okay, if you keep going past the bar.
Right.
There's
towards, like, the bathroom.
Sink. Thank you. Yeah. There's
literally.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Literally, but
yeah,
instead
sucks.
Of right across from the bathroom, I'm
yeah.
right across from the sink. So it's
yeah.
an open sink area where they're washing dishes and stuff. And I was like, I'm not
no
doing
way.
This.
No, fuck you.
And I held my ground, and I end up at this gorgeous table exactly where I wanted to be because there are prolific two tops,
right.
you know,
right,
right there.
Right.
And I start to cry. And I cry because this octopus tastes like wood. It tastes like fire. It tastes like the ocean. It's everything. Synthesized, gorgeous, plated beautifully. I mean, I'm just, you know, just overwhelmed by this. But I'm also realizing... this is what I've been denying myself. This
experience.
This experience
versus
this
room service.
Food
versus
exactly. room service. Because no room service, at least in my budget, no room service is that transcendental. You know, like
I don't. I mean, I travel all over the world.
It's
I never
offensive.
Have room service.
You don't because you're not supposed to.
I used to work in hotels. It's like it's downstairs in some shit kitchen.
God.
It's the least. It's the thing they care about the least.
Shit.
And then it sits in that little dolly, it goes sits, up the elevator, and it's steaming
you know,
and getting cold.
Exactly. And you know, it's just.
And you're eating by
never,
yourself in a room.
You're alone.
Watching
in a room,
CNN.
But you're not seen. And what I realized was no one gives two fucks about me sitting in a restaurant, eating, and I had deprived myself. No one else had deprived me of
this.
See,
it's funny.
I did it.
It's. I think in America, okay, you're Italian thing, but in America, it's so stigmatized. And I see it all the time in Paris. I see it all the time in other parts of Europe. And then I there was a time when I wrote a guidebook to New York City, and I had to go out a lot. And it was on my dime to go out, because, you know, you get these advances from your publisher that cover, like, two pairs of sneakers.
Do you want to eat, or do you want to get paid?
That's right. You want a Metro card, or you want new sneakers, kids? You can't have both with this check. So I was eating out a lot, and I actually loved that experience, but I definitely knew it was kind of a stigma because you're a single guy.
Well, first of all, you're a single white guy, and I'm like a single brown girl. I don't want to get too gendered and you know, whatever here, but
correct.
There's a
white guys can pretty much do anything they want. I can just sit there in my underwear smoking
probably.
A cigar. Maybe.
You know, but you can, and you know, even if you're feeling embarrassed on the inside, on the outside, no one's looking at you.
No,
and
I was embarrassed, but I just love the idea. I get so much out of it. It was almost like here's what I thought.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and I felt this way with, I've always felt this way with reviewers too, like, sometimes you have a great meal out, and part of the greatness of the meal was there was four people at the table, and you were just killing it. You were crushing it. You were having fun, and everyone's laughing. And I'm not sure you're paying attention to the food, but it was great because you had so much fun. But when you're eating alone, it's like you zero in. It's like a laser. So maybe you've got your headphones in, or you got some buds on, or you're just reading a book, but there's no distraction.
Right.
So I find as a critic, to eat alone was so much more revealing than to be distracted.
I am now realizing, I mean, this is a fairly new experience.
100% of your focus is on how long did it take to get this plate. Not that you're counting with your but you know, what's the flow? And then you can observe the room better.
Yes.
Because there's no, so how's the staff doing? What's this place feel like? And then when the food comes, you're just zeroed in on that. So I kind of, really my takeaway was eating alone is a great way as a critic or as a gourmand to appreciate food.
Or as a human.
Or
you
as
know?
A human. Just, I mean, we don't need to be surrounded by people all the time.
I start with the poem Feast, you know, Love After Love by Derek Walcott. And it ends with the line, feast on your life. And this was really what I was trying to say to people. Look, there's all these ways we can eat with diversity. We can experience and really support the kind of food system we want. This is like one place where we actually have the power to do it if we pay attention and make different kinds of decisions. But ultimately, what I want you to do is get back to that place of loving what you eat and not feeling disconnected from it. And that journey took me 5 years to own what I loved. You know, tons of sensory training. I break down in the book all the senses, how we experience exactly what you were saying before about food. We experience the same meal differently whether we're sitting in our cubicle, you know, reheating it over lunch versus like having a candlelit dinner with our partner, you know. So, and it could be the exact same food. It's like everything is contextual and everything is dynamic. It's always changing whether we realize it or not. So we are open to these experiences and we can have them. And then there's guides, you know, like how do you taste wine? How do you taste beer? How do you taste chocolate or
let's
coffee?
Let's go to chocolate.
Yeah.
I have wine. This show is ad nauseum. I have wine. Guess, I mean, last I spent. So this is supposed to be
wine day.
This is supposed to be it's American Wine Day or something. Cheers. Somebody emailed me that. Someone was trying to get a guest on. I'm like, sorry, booked. Yeah. But yeah. So we talk about wine a lot. It's totally, that's in my wheelhouse. But chocolate's interesting. So around the corner from here, when you leave maybe, pop your head in the door. If you go out and make a left and left, it's on Siegel Street, which is right behind us, like that way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place called Fine and Raw.
Mm.
And an interesting guy, Daniel Sklar, got into chocolate. A South African guy got the chocolate. He, you know, and it's, we just had a big bean to bar gate. Kerfuffle in New York. You read about
that. I wrote about it.
You wrote about it. So we're not going to drag. I'm not going to go into that arena.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a guy that's doing this in a very small scale.
Yeah.
You go in there. You see the beans. Yep. He's got the double. He doesn't do a lot of production.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because chocolate's something that's such a flashpoint today.
Mm-hmm.
So let's pour down. So I'm going to ask a question before that. I'll just frame it. For a long time in America, not so much in Europe, especially like if you were in France where they really were into their bonbons and chocolate.
Really?
Switzerland, they were really into it. They really valued it. It was the English to a lesser extent because it was a little more milk chocolate, but whatever. But to America, chocolate was just this cheap commodity shit. It was Mars and Hershey. Mm-hmm. Can't cost more than 50 cents or a dollar. Mm-hmm. Open it up, chew it, throw out the wrapper, you're done.
Yeah.
And boom, now you fast forward to today where you're saying, wait a second, the farmers that are growing chocolate, which is not an easy thing to grow, and it's the middle of nowhere where there's mosquitoes and snakes and parasites, and the yield is shit. Like, you know how many cocoa it's like 200 to make a pound. It's like nuts. The amount of work to, and the least, the like as is typically the case, the person that gets paid the least are the farmers.
Right.
Middlemen make all the money.
Yes.
And then some at the end.
Well, yeah, some at the end. Yeah.
So what's your takeaway on chocolate these days? Because I am perfectly happy.
Right.
Because part of the bean to bar gate thing was it just kept coming up. I'm never going to pay $10 for a chocolate bar. Chocolate bar's not worth $10. I'm
right.
not going to pay
$10.
I say bullshit.
Right.
If it's a great bar of chocolate, a bar that's like this big, let's say, you know,
sure.
and that's not a bar of chocolate that you eat in one sitting.
Right.
Honestly, in my case, that's not a bar of chocolate you eat in three sittings.
Yeah.
It's like break off a piece
exactly.
at the end of the after dinner, put it in your mouth, woof, yeah. let that magic happen, and it's like 20 minutes worth of pleasure from yeah. like a bite. So I'm perfectly okay with it. What's your I read the book, but I want you to flesh it out.
For sure.
Talk about chocolate.
So chocolate is my love, and you know, just briefly to say, when that becomes a shorthand, well, we don't want to pay more for all this stuff. I want to back up and just say, Americans, you know, we are the country that pays less for a percentage, you know, of our income for food than any other developed country in the world, less than we used to pay during the Great Depression. So there's that challenge first and foremost, that we keep this drive to the bottom, this drive to cheapness.
6.7%.
Exactly.
From your book, I'm taking that number.
Thank you, sir. Yes. And that, you know, and that, I mean, that isn't my statistic. That's a labor statistic. And that to me points to a challenge right there. The knee-jerk response is it's too expensive. Why are people paid so little that this is all we can afford? A. B. Why have we decided that 99 cents is sufficient to cover the cost of it? Now, you can pretty much put garbage cacao is the crop that becomes chocolate, into your product when you cover it up with a lot of other things. Vanillin, corn syrup, you know, caramel, nougat, whatever. Like, it doesn't matter. It's like going and getting a mochaccino with lots of whipped cream and what have you on it. What did that coffee taste like? Who knows? Who cares? But if you care, and if you don't want to settle and you want the good stuff, then we should be paying people an equitable wage to enable them to sustain it, to enable them to live. And we're not talking about people who are minting money. It looks like it. Until you really look at the numbers, $10, $13 for a bar of chocolate seems insane. Then you start to look at the yield. Then you start to look at how hard it is to transport these products, whether it's chocolate, coffee, what have you. Then you start to look at these makers and what they're doing, sorting beans, painstakingly putting this stuff together. It starts at the farm. If you want a quality product, you're going to start that right in the ground, and you're going to carry that all the way through. And I'll tell you exactly what you were saying is absolutely right. You can experience chocolate the way you experience a fine bottle of wine or a fine glass of wine. You want a PBR? Pound that. You want a craft beer? Take your time with it, right? A little bit more time with it. You want a nice bar of chocolate? Savor it. And what you will experience, I describe in the book, it's like the equivalent of, you know, like, I don't know, skimming a magazine versus reading like a really good book. Like, they're just not the same things. And I will have both of them. I will cut you for a Twix in an airport. I will. I love me some Twix bars. But they're different things, and they're different experiences, and they support completely different systems.
Yeah, and to your point, I've been making this for years, because I travel a lot overseas. I mean, Europe seems like a third of the year some years,
mm-hmm.
and that's been that way for a long time. And I remember like the very first few times as a young chef, you know, I was in my 20s and I'm in Europe, and I would go to a market and see the, like, a poulet de Bresse, a chicken, a French chicken of a particular province or provenance, you know, cost the equivalent in America. This was back in the 80s. It was like $18 or $20, you know, and you could buy that, like, in America. You would go to a supermarket and buy a Purdue or a Tyson chicken for, like, you know, $1.90 fucking nine.
Wrapped in plastic.
Yeah. It probably had been frozen, because the chickens are allowed to transport frozen in America, because apparently chickens at 18 degrees aren't frozen. It's not frozen. It's like, again, back to labeling laws and deceit.
Right.
But so the Europeans are used to paying these big prices for protein, for beef, for chicken, for fish, and what's the take? They eat less of it. A bird would feed 4 or 5 people,
indeed,
versus in America, like, our portion sizes. So everything's cheap. The portions have to be huge. It's like we've got this whole thing ass backwards.
Right.
Get great ingredients.
Yeah.
Support great agricultural systems that are with the farmers
producers
being paid, and eat less protein. Pay more for food, just eat less bullshit.
Well, you know, and that's the thing, like, these things have been engineered for hyperpalatability. All those processed foods are meant to, like, tweak our taste buds. Yeah. So we want more and more, but we are it's disguising the truth of what that product is. And when you do that, you're inhaling it. You're not paying attention anymore. I think consciousness, quality, like you said, I mean, that's when you said, you know, Europeans will pay more for protein. I would argue they pay more for quality.
Yeah,
quality
no.
vegetables, yeah. quality breads, yep. what have you, that it's this idea that
it's
like
a lifestyle.
It's a lifestyle. And
like
we're
Italy's
it.
You were in Italy's been yeah. going to hell in a handbasket for 50 years. And they had fucking Berlusconi for 12 years.
You know,
a pedophile maniac.
Is there, yeah.
but they don't give a shit. Like they don't care if the trains run on time, if
that's
the government's going
that's
broke.
The
how was the risotto tonight? How are the tomatoes?
Mia.
Did you try those clams?
See.
That's all that matters.
And you know, the tradition, because it's yeah. part of who they are.
Yeah.
And I think in large DNA. Order, we have lost that connection. We are what we eat. I argued this in the book, and I went actually, you know, to Morocco with one of the chefs from Chez Panisse, and he said, Jerome, we eat what we are. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't even understand the concept of your sentence. And then I realized, of course we do. Of course, what we're eating is also a reflection of who we are. And so this drive toward the bottom, this, you know, this supersizing, this fast fooding of everything, it just, of course, if it costs you 50 cents, who cares if you throw it away? You never even knew the true cost of what that was. But it takes 2 seconds for us to process this through and say, there is no human way, there's no possible way meat could be this cheap. There is no possible way these things could be transported from so far away and be the prices that they are. And if we actually start to think about that, I think we'll realize we want a different system. Because I'll tell you right now, I get no joy from a 99-cent bottomless cup of coffee because someone didn't get paid. And it wasn't yeah. Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks.
I think now the only advantage to being old or getting there is that you have a breadth of vision that's historical. I'm speaking of me.
Oh, so, I was going to say, are we both
no,
in there?
No, but, me,
I mean,
no,
old,
me, you know. Not you. Okay. So I grew up in like the 60s. I'm going to be 60
yet.
This year.
Yeah,
so I was
okay.
born in 56. So mm-hmm. I kind of grew up in the 60s and early 70s. And that was really, I think, like the darkest time for American cuisine mm. for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
There was the women's lib movement. Women didn't want to be their moms.
Right.
The supermarkets had really killed small markets. Wonder Bread made like bakery seem obsolete.
Right.
There was a move towards convenience. I mean, Jackie Onassis, one of her favorite meals was TV dinner.
Yes.
She loved that.
The
like the
status.
First, the first TV dinner was like that. Like they had that in the White House, like a Tyson TV, like whatever whoever made
a little
that.
A foil, you
right.
know.
So the
a
idea
portioned.
Was convenience
yeah.
trumped everything. American cheese, white bread, spam.
Right.
I
right.
remember families
technology.
Drinking Tang.
Yes.
Like why
of
drink orange? Juice and you could
no.
put this powder, add water and stir. So I lived through that. And my point is that now I look at like this generation around Roberta's. I look at these yeah. kids in this neighborhood, the kids in the studio. And as an old guy, you can shit on everything. Oh, it's great in the old days. You know what? It's the
You're
best
the
now. The food scene now in America in the last 15, 18 years between farmers markets, mm-hmm. bakeries popping up mm-hmm. and doing incredibly good bread,
oh, yeah.
chocolatiers,
yeah.
the wine that's coming into this country, mm-hmm. the cooking that's taking place is so much better than it's ever been. So, and I think that people are getting used to this idea of what you're talking about,
yeah.
I think. I mean, it's probably in urban areas. It's probably in certain demographics. It's probably a certain educational...
Disagreeing with you across
okay,
the board.
Okay, good.
Because I moved from Lawrence, Kansas, and I'll tell you... So we're talking about an educated demographic, but...
That is. Lawrence
I
is
actually
like
think... I taught at KU. Yeah. yeah you know, it's the blue dot in the red state, but...
Right.
but the thing that I think is so spectacular is it isn't just happening. It's happening in immigrant communities. It's happening okay. among young people. Yesterday, I was actually sitting with Megan Larmer from Slow Food USA, and she said, this is the first time, like, our convivial leaders are young. Like, that this movement, people are owning it. And I think it's through stuff like craft beer. I talk about beer in the book. It's like, we're not talking about big leaps here. We're talking about curiosity. We're talking about getting to the roots of things. And we live in an era where we can actually pull out a phone and figure out where things come from. This is unprecedented. So the story is so readily available. I think populations are living into that story, you know, and it's exactly what you said. I mean, I was on the edge of Tang, you know, I was born in the 70s in 70. But I think what we had was that sense of seasonality. What we had was that memory of having someone cook for us. And I mean, you are a chef. So, you know, that's a different kind of story. But that got lost in the middle and it's coming back now. So it's actually a return.
I think so.
To
I mean,
who
I see the pendulum coming back
yeah.
and I'm hoping, I don't want to be overly optimistic, but
yeah.
I'm hoping that this kind of what started as a grassroots movement that's growing in America, it's really getting, it's becoming a chorus. And there's more and more. And you're right. It's not just so, I mean, look at the food scene in Charleston. Look at the food yeah. scene in Birmingham, Alabama.
Absolutely.
I mean,
Asheville, North Carolina.
Asheville, North Carolina. I mean, there's New York can't handle all of the talent. Chicago. So a lot of these chefs that were training here, they're saying, I want to go home. I want to go somewhere else where I can have a quality of life. Maybe I can afford a house. Want to raise my kids. And I'm going to do great food there.
It's not fancy there either. I mean, like, you go to Berkeley and farm to table is like, you know, a neon sign. You go to Lawrence and it's like, it's just what we do. I mean, I will tell you, my favorite restaurant is Hank's Charcuterie in Lawrence, Kansas, because it ain't no thing there. It just is how we, you know, of course we know where the meat came from.
And I think this, you could say much of the same for the southeast of America,
absolutely,
the southern states.
Absolutely.
They've been like Italy forever. I mean, grits and polenta are the same thing. They catch what they eat. They hunt what they eat. They eat seasonally. They trade stuff. I'll trade you peaches for your grits. I mean, that's like America home cooking.
I think so. Right? That's who we are.
That is who we are.
And, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, so I'm all about the grits and the barbecue, and I'm Indian. And I think that these things transcend these lines. And it's just a question of, like, where do we want to invest our time and energy? What do we love? And the democratization of this, that we don't have to look to Zagat or, you know, Michelin stars or Yelp reviews, that we can start to say, what I tried to do in the book. Like, define
Michelin,
this for yourself.
Fuck Zagat, fuck Yelp.
Listen,
please.
Most people, no, but truly, I mean, if we circled back, if we had time to that Maskgate thing, a lot of it was people like, okay, I don't know what Bean to Bar is. It's like, also, okay, we all just listened to the tastemakers and we decided that what we experienced didn't matter because we felt shame. We felt shame in saying, like, oh, well, the New York Times liked it. I mean, Eater liked it. Why don't I like it? Okay, I like it. You know, and I think the most important thing I think in what I put out in my book is that this belongs to all of us. Define your own deliciousness. Mm. And when you do that, when you take ownership back for yourself,
I was thinking when you said that,
you know, when you love it, when you have, when you're in relationship with it, you will want it to be better.
How long are you in New York for?
Not long enough. I leave tomorrow.
You leave tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll be back.
So in this neighborhood, just again, behind us is a guy that's doing this really nice bean bar. Mm-hmm. He's a small, humble guy.
He's not roasting, but I do love me some roasted, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, he doesn't. He doesn't roast, but he conches forever, 48 hours, and that's heat. And in a way, there's kind of something going on in there. It's not exactly cooking, but it's kind of there. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy down the street this way. If you made a right-hand turn out of Roberta,
he's
cool. Mm-hmm. So what he's doing is he's got a hopper. Uh-huh. And he's getting whole grain wheat from all over America.
Fantastic.
Yesterday, the bar was from Kansas. Oh. So the bread I had, the loaf I had. So he had these 50-pound bags of that he's buying from normally producers that would sell to mills that would turn it into flour. Mm-hmm. He said, no, sell me the whole grain. Mm-hmm. He grinds it. It's sophisticated enough that he can separate the different parts, the germ and the da-da-da. And he does that with some of the breads. But he's baking whole wheat bread.
Fantastic.
A lot of times he'll put the gnarlier parts in at the end so they don't cut the gluten strands.
Mm-hmm.
But he's doing it down the street here. Whole grain from the whole grain to the loaf in a place. Then there's a guy one stop away from here at the restaurant called Faro who's got a little small German grinder, grain grinder, doing the same thing with just New York upstate wheat.
Fantastic.
And he's using spelt, he's using corn, he's using rye. It's crazy. I mean, he made a porridge. I mean, like, I went to the restaurant the first time, like, just unannounced to go in to do my homework, and I'm like, fucking porridge on them. I'm like, porridge is like something you fed prisoners. Like, how can you
actually used to feed them lobster, sir?
That's true. That's a fact. But no, you know what I mean. And porridge is like, oh my god, it's
right?
Like, what are we having for dinner? Not
it's
porridge
like
again.
What? Yeah.
But he tastes his porridge. It's like revelatory. It's like, whoa, it's amazing.
You're gonna take me
because his grains are insane, and he does all of his breads. He does all of his pasta the same way.
Yeah.
One subway stop from here. So it's crazy. And we're in the middle of, you know, bupkis bullshit Brooklyn. Middle of nowhere. And it's happening here, too.
And it's happening in Asheville. And it's happening in Kansas. Yeah. And it's happening. The revolution is everywhere.
So
it's just a question of looking for it.
So to celebrate this book. And again, what I loved about it was it wasn't didactic or doctrinaire. Because there's so many of these, you know, politically correct treaties things. I'm just so tired of people talking.
It's not.
It's your story. You're just woven through it. You are the this is really, you're the DNA of this thing. Bread, wine, chocolate, the slow loss of the foods we love. That's the name of the book. The author is Simran Sethi. So thanks so much for coming out to Bushwick.
Thank you. Fun.
Yeah. Safe travels. I know this book's going to do great. Keep up the great work and fighting the good fight.
Thanks,
folks. Stay tuned next week. I don't know who's on, but we've always got good guests. So stay tuned. We'll be back next Thursday, same time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage _Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.